Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
To each other tonight, I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly.
And each night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics that you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
With you tonight, I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
It is time for It's the Law segment of the Dresser After Dark show, and it's Michael Hohmeyer back with us. Michael, hi, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Great as always to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm going to go hide. I keep listening to everything that's on the news, and I listen to the different takes that we have on things, and I have to say, I'm not coming out of the closet forever. Or maybe
I
should say.
Yeah, I understand the feeling. It's almost there's so much going on. It's a blizzard. It's fast and furious.
No, absolutely, and especially when we take a look at what's going on in government, left side, right side, you know, it almost doesn't matter anymore. Something came up on the air the other night. And the question, it's been haunting me for 2 days, and when the guest comes back, I'm going to ask the question. But it went something like this, and I think it is a question that begs to be put on the table and asked. The question, the comment was basically, we send billions of dollars to Brazil, they're going to do offshore drilling, and we're going to be their customer, and yada, yada. And the response came back that it's more than just giving the money to them to do the drilling. Because of the trickle-down effect and the different dollars and politically and the different incomes that will be increased from different countries that will allow us to do this and that. And now that we are we're an international community, quote-unquote. And after the show was over, the thought that hit me was one that it stayed with me. And the question would be this, at what cost?
Right. From a lawyer's perspective, we're always trained to be thinking that question all the time. There's always a cost. Sometimes it's hidden. Part of our job is to ferret it out and see what it is and say to the client, these are consequences to what you do. There are direct and indirect. There are close-up, and then there are down-the-road consequences. But the consequences can be as real and as significant down the road as the immediate ones. If a client wants to buy a business, okay, we can assist you in buying your business. But once you've bought that business, what are you going to do with the employees? What are you going to do with the warehouse and the lease you may have for the warehouse? What are you doing with the intellectual property? What are you doing with the corporation that you acquire? In other words, there are more issues than just the immediate, as if the immediate ones aren't significant enough on their own. And, of course, they are. But you always have to be thinking about the long-term, down-the-road consequences of every action you do.
Okay, now let's talk consequences here. The consequence for doing what we're doing is we get deeper in debt. We have people on welfare that we can't even take care of that. We have people on Medicare that they're not being able to take care of that. There are the job losses in the industry that we did have here that we don't have here anymore after NAFTA and GATT and the rest of them. And then we take a look at the consequence. I really believe at what cost the answer, and I did not like the answer I came up with. The answer was to give up who we are and become a third world country down the road, whereby government controls all and we become automatons and we wear the same uniforms and everybody who disagrees gets taken out in the back and shot.
These are the very issues that need to be thought of. There are others in addition to the ones that you've mentioned, but those that you did list are certainly significant issues, the economic impact followed by the loss of liberty. There's also the geopolitical or the international foreign policy ramifications of, for example, a decision to enhance Brazil's oil production at the expense of American oil production and the consequences that could have on our foreign policy, Venezuela and Iran are cooperating significantly. They're talking about putting Iranian-guided missiles in Venezuela in order to threaten us. Brazil has been a lukewarm friend to us over the last 6 years. So there are consequences beyond just a potential loss of freedom. There's even potentially the loss of life that could ensue from some of the decisions that are being taken today.
Absolutely. And Michael, when we take a look at it and we do what it looks like we're moving to do now, there are people who want to run for office that would like to stop this immediately and bring us back to who we are. You know, we lose our strength. We're divided. The divide in this country, I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. I watched the school kids in Arizona yelling, we should give the Arizona back to Mexico, and the list goes on. And the confusion that we have as far as what is education, what is America. And when we talk about what is education, we go back years ago when there was auto shop, there was metal shop, there was wood shop. It was training these kids, or when I was a kid, if you weren't going on to higher education, it was training you to go out and get a job and make a living. They don't have that anymore, and not everybody's going to be a computer tech. There's still going to be those hands-on jobs. And the social engineering that's going on is unbelievable. Some of the things that they're teaching kids. Why does a grammar school kid, almost rhetorically, why does a grammar school kid in the second, third, and fourth grade have to know about the different genders and the third gender, and why should there be a gender coach in the grammar school? We're getting so off track that we're losing ourselves.
Absolutely right. And though a lot of folks share the same frustration that you have, and that I also share, and that frustration is manifesting itself in bottom-up movements like the Tea Party.
Absolutely.
The huge significance of the Tea Party is not so much its alignment, not so much which side of the political spectrum it's on, but the fact that it's a totally mass movement, self-formed, self-organized, or if you want to, self-disorganized still. But it is an organization that sprang up from the grassroots, not from the top down because some political party thought it would be a good idea or some elite thought it would be smart to organize some populist thing here. This is a bottom-up creation, and it is created by people's frustration with the very things you're talking about. And while its prominence today is obviously a huge measure of people's frustration, it also gives cause for a lot of hope that enough people are feeling the same way as you and me to stand up and be counted and have their voices heard and take action and do things like affect the election of last year and hopefully affect next year's election. These people are not just satisfied with talking or venting or finding kindred spirits like you and me. They want action. I suspect you and I do too.
No, but what we've got is, you're talking about, I'm going to be tongue-in-cheek here. You're talking about the Tea Party. You mean those horrible anti-American racists? You see, there's the problem, Michael. Yeah, you hear that all of a sudden we're going to dig up something. We're going to call them something. We're going to delude them.
Yes. We know what we are, though. And, sticks and stones, all the labels do nothing but make the point of the Tea Partiers. The teabagger, calumny, all the other mislabels saying that the Tea Partiers are racist and the like, people don't buy that anymore. And instead of shutting down debate, it merely invigorates people to say, okay, we really are at the enough point now. Something you and I talked about when last we spoke was one of the good things of the current administration is it has brought forth the day of reckoning sooner than the drip that we were undergoing over the last 20 years. So in a sense, it's done us a favor by bringing matters to a head today. It's better that we address them today than another 10 years from now. In a sense, it's a very good thing that things have gotten so bad because we have a chance to reverse them soon and hopefully reverse them before further damage could have been done by more of the drip.
No, absolutely. And what have we seen happening? We've seen We've seen companies move from different states. They move out of a state because the state is taking too much taxes. It's tax this, tax that. I understand that it's cash in, cash out, and there's an accounting system. The government makes its money through taxes and it spends. If it spends too much, we're in deficit. If it doesn't, if it makes more than it spends, you know, we're in the black, and which is all well and good. We haven't been that way since the Clinton administration. Now the problem is I don't get why we are spending so much money, we are borrowing so much money, and I'm going to add a little bit to what you said early on. Let's take China, for instance. China sells us goods and services, etc. So what do? We pay them cash. They take that same cash that we paid them for, and some of those goods really aren't worth the whatever it is that they were brought here on, and we pay them cash, and they take that money, and they buy a property. They buy us back up again. So they're using our money to buy us, and that's happening all over the world right now, and the administration, any administration, is not looking at that. Or if they do, they're giving it a blind eye, and then there's a reason behind everything that's going on right now. They cannot be that stupid, and it's not dumb. Michael, it's stupid.
Were it honest, yes, you'd call it stupid, because God knows we know already, it's been tried so many times, that the track record is truly self-evident, that when you increase taxes, you diminish tax receipts. If you want to increase the amount of government of money that government takes in, lower taxes, that will result in increased economic activity, which will, at a lower tax rate, generate increased revenue to government. So really, the people who are interested in generating more money for government, whether it's federal, state, or local, are actually conservatives and not liberals. But setting that aside for the moment, which, by the way, is empirically provable over 30 or 40 years of trial and effect, and it's in the historical record. You can see what happens each year that you do this, or how do you get out of a recession. You can track it. You can see that it's the truth. That's the stupidity factor. When people ignore that they've tried this before and look at the result, they always get the same result. They're stupid if they continue. So we must start thinking that folks aren't so stupid. And instead, as you've often said, there's a suspicion that they're not stupid, but what they're interested in doing is bringing about the reduction in the American standard of living that we are about to experience, or indeed may well be experiencing already with this protracted recession. That is, they don't believe in American exceptionalism. They don't think we're any better than anybody else. And the fact that our standard of living has been higher is something that they're out to correct by reducing us down to the standard of living of everybody else in the world. And so if folks aren't stupid, then they must have an ill intent in mind.
No, absolutely. That the progressives today, not the Democrats, not the liberals, but the progressives, are undermining the economy. You destroy the economy, you replace the economy with whatever it is that you want, and then it's more and more government control, more nationalism, and that list goes on. But one of the things that I think is coming to the fore is the reactions of, are really being brought to the table now, is the reactions of our different elected representatives. They can do anything that they want to do, and that's the end of it. You saw it in the Tea Parties, the condescending attitudes toward the constituents, those people that voted in office. They seem to forget who is working for who, and that in and of itself is scary. And if you're going to vote somebody into office, you do not want to vote somebody in that's going to be in charge of controlling the way your life is going to be run, who sends a picture of himself out on Twitter in underwear.
Absolutely right. Folks have said and are saying and will say next year, I believe, enough already, enough with this stupidity, enough with this childish behavior, enough with these elite people who think they know better and should be allowed and empowered to make all the decisions in place of our individual responsibility to make our own decisions in our own lives. Those people who want to take over, have all the power, and run everybody's lives according to their own fiat, we've had it with those folks. We're not listening to them anymore. We're not going to let them remain in power. We're taking it away from them. The story that started last year with the elections has not been finished. It's not completely written yet. There's a second chapter coming next year.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. But the mold of those people who are going to take over, they've got to be able to stand up for themselves. I don't know whether or not Romney is going to be strong enough to do this. I'm kind of favoring, and he hasn't thrown his hat into the arena, and he may not, but the governor of Texas. I like this guy. He's strong. He's he's got it together.
Rick Perry.
And this is exactly what we're looking for. We need somebody who knows how to lead, who's not afraid, and who's going to move forward, but with the intent at all times that America is America. We don't go out into the world and apologize for who we are. There have been things that have gone on. There has been slavery, and there's been, you know, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, that's not who we are today. We haven't been that way for many, many years now. There is not a door closed to any ethnicity, any gender, anybody who there's not a law that says open the door up. There is not an educational system that you can't get into today. The problem that we're having is those are all used as weapons. And I say weapons to stop people to move in the direction that you want to do. If I label you, if I call you a name, if I do something, then I've got you to a point. If you open your mouth, I call you a racist, I'm going to shut you up. Or you're going to have to explain to me you're not. You're totally off track. See, there's where the problem is. There's racism, and there's so many things going on today that really aren't going on today. But it's used as a political weapon to garner a vote.
It absolutely is, and people have had a bellyful of it.
Yeah, take a defensive posture, you know, and I've got you. But that's,
and
you just said it.
People don't want to hear that anymore.
No. And we live still in the greatest country in the entire world. Why would you, and you've heard me say this before rhetorically, and you in the general sense of the word, why would you run from a place that you were afraid of, that weren't treating you like a human being, come to a country like this and try to make this like the place that you left? I don't get that.
That's not what most people who come here are really looking for. There are the agitators, the loudmouths, the people who've got the mainstream media in their pocket. They sell newspapers. They, you know, get viewers to certain TV channels. But those people are almost entertainers. It's like a freak show. And yes, it does get attention, but the attention isn't the same as approval. I think people would just assume that this Democrat congressman with the Twitter issue would just go away. There are very serious, very real issues that need to be addressed. And the fact that the media is focusing so much attention on something like this, most of us on this side of the aisle knew the guy was a jerk. This just proved it, in case anybody who's objective needed to know. We know he's a jerk, but look, let's get back to the real issues. But instead, the media wants to distract us from those issues by saying, we'll even hold up one of our own and try to say, look at him, don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. You know what? We want to pull the curtain away and go after the guy behind the curtain, not this distraction that they're trying to put in front of us.
No, absolutely. And when it really comes down to it, Michael, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I am an American. And if we're not very careful, the definition of what being an American is going to dwindle away. And it's very hard today to navigate a very complex system that we've created. It's a reversible cause and effect. It's not just administrations, but to navigate through this and have any kind of an understanding or any kind of a say, you got to get in there and you got to be tough. And I think, and I'm going to say this every day until the day that I can't say it anymore, that you got to live by John Wayne's code. You ready for this? Life is tough, but when you're stupid, it's worse.
Well, and isn't that true? And you know what?
Yes.
I have an awful lot of faith in the common sense of the American people, at least the majority, a clear majority of the American people. And my sense is that they don't believe this bill of fare that we've all been sold, that only the smart folks, the self-appointed elites, are clever enough to lead us forward in our lives. With all these ridiculously complicated answers to these silly, complicated questions, most people think the answers are pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Are we going to raise the debt limit? No. Why? Because we'll keep spending over that limit. Instead, people say no, simply no. Not maybe this and maybe that. People just say no, don't raise the debt limit. And not only did Republicans hear that message, but so did half of the Democratic caucus in the vote not to raise the debt ceiling when that matter by itself was put to a vote of the entire House. And that means it's because they know that when the people get into the polling booth, they don't listen to all those sophisticated, nuanced arguments. They're going to vote yes or no, black or white, on or off, however you want to say it, but it's a stark choice, and all of these silly complexities don't really matter, and people are not being fooled by them anymore.
Michael, I could talk to you all night. We're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
You notice I said you can give your website, but I'm not telling anybody where to find me.
Well, we're willing to stand up for ourselves, our beliefs, and certainly those of our clients.
Anytime. Okay. Hey, Michael, see you next week.
You bet. Thanks, Michael Ray.
Mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Places to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just...
Mark Seal is with us. He's the author of The Man in the Rockefeller Suit, The Astonishing Rise and Spectacular Fall of a Serial Imposter. Mark's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of the critically acclaimed book, Wildflower. An Extraordinary Life and Mysterious Death in Africa. And it's about the murdered wildlife filmmaker and naturalist Joan Root. He was the 2010 a National Magazine Award finalist for his Vanity Fair profile of Clark Rockefeller. And let us say, Mark, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The Man in the Rockefeller Suit. What is it so mysterious about someone who is an imposter that lives life after life after life? And I wonder how many of us see themselves in these kind of people.
Yeah, this guy, he came to America in 1978 and just began creating identities for himself, one after another, increasingly brazen, increasingly upscale, increasingly everything, you know, from Christopher Chichester, who was supposed to be a nephew of Lord Mountbatten, to Christopher Crowe, a director and Wall Street figure, to finally Clark Rockefeller, a New York and Boston bon vivant, and supposedly a real Rockefeller, of which, of course, was not true.
Now, obviously, this is something that somebody did. We're talking about reality here, and people don't want to go that far as far as kill somebody. But I would imagine that people will see themselves because they want to take on different identities. You know, life can be very humdrum at times, and they see themselves, and it's almost an adventure, kind of a sick adventure, but it's still an adventure. So I guess the real question is, what was it about him that caught you? What caused you to put this account to pen?
Well, what made me interested in the story was he abducted his daughter from a Boston street in the late summer of 2008 and was suddenly national news. And everybody wanted to know, who was this guy? And people who thought he was a Rockefeller for so many years all of that began to unravel and all these identities started appearing. So that's what caught my attention. And once I wrote the story in Vanity Fair, I was just hooked. You know, it was so, this man, what he did and how he portrayed himself to others was so fascinating to me. And every step along the way got more and more interesting.
Now, by the way, in you changing identities like that, someone could, if whatever that was that got him caught, someone could kill somebody. Someone could make their wife disappear. Someone could do all of these things because it wasn't him. It was the other identity.
That's right. Well, he was a person of interest for, you know, 28 years in a missing persons case out in California. And they knew that he was a couple of these identities, but they did not know he was living in New York in plain sight as Clark Rockefeller, the authorities. So it wasn't until he abducted his daughter that kind of the lid blew off of this 30-year con, I guess, if you want to call it that, and all these identities became known.
Yeah, very interesting when we think about it. If you broke him down psychologically, I wonder if the man had it together and was smart enough to do what he was doing, or when he moved to a different identity, he actually became that person for that time in his own
mind. I think so. Yeah, I think he fully lived each one of these identities. And what happened in the end was he was married and he had a young daughter. And the daughter was the only thing in his life that he couldn't lie to or cheat or con. He fell in love with this little girl. And so when he was divorced from his wife and he lost custody of his daughter, that's when he set in motion this plan to abduct his daughter and have her for himself. And that, by doing that, he blew the lid off of everything. If he hadn't have done that, he probably still would be living in some sense of relative comfort as one of these identities.
Is there anybody else in our history, in our criminal history, not we as a nation, but in the criminal history within the context of our set of rules, our laws, our regulations, has anybody else been like this? Has anybody even reached the pinnacle of that ability to deceive and be so many different people and have people believe it?
Well, there's been different variation of the imposter all through our history, and I did some research into it. It didn't really make it into the book, the history of all of this, but I more or less wrote it out and was going to include it, but then I didn't for various reasons. But we have a great history of wild imposters in this country and around the world. I mean, just to name one, Frank Avanel, who did Catch Me If You Can. I mean, was an imposter as well. But I think this guy, Clark Rockefeller, may be pushed it to the ultimate limit.
Yeah, and when you take a look at him, I've got the book in front of me, which is fascinating. And you go to, it doesn't have the number of the page with the pictures, but it's got the different pictures of him and how different he looked through the entire thing. He took on an identity, and it's his face, but yet it wasn't his face.
I know, it's just like he inhabited these people, and they weren't ordinary people. I mean, from the direct descendant of Lord Mountbatten living in a little town in California outside of L.A., to Christopher Crowe, a Wall Street player, you know, who also could direct Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the television show in his spare time, and finally to Clark Rockefeller, which, I mean, some of the claims he claimed that he was doing, he said he was going to be appointed to the Federal Reserve Board, that he worked for the CIA, that he was close with the Rockefeller family. I mean, it one thing after another. You just couldn't believe the boast that he made.
You know what I've always thought? Go ahead.
No, but people did believe. That's what makes it fascinating, that people did believe him. And these were not, you know, ignorant people. These were smart, intelligent, educated people with, high society in some cases, high stratas in business and education. So these were, you know, people who believed him.
You know, what I thought for many, many years now, which I always thought was fascinating, was a true criminal mind. Not just a criminal mind, not just a bad guy, but a true criminal mind. These guys are brilliant. And I wonder what would happen if they would have just shifted into something constructive. My goodness, what these guys could accomplish.
Oh, yeah, because this man is so intelligent. Of course, he came here. He didn't have a job. He went to college for a number of years, and then he began educating himself in public libraries. Just to give you an idea, when he first came here from Germany, he still had a German accent, and the family he stayed with in Connecticut said he would sit in front of the television set watching Gilligan's Island and mimicking the speech of Thurston Howell III. Remember the East Coast millionaire?
Yeah.
And that's how he got his accent in the beginning.
Now, with a guy like this, did he ever open up to the why, the wherefore? Has anybody got really inside of him?
No, he has not. Even up to his trial for kidnapping his daughter, parental kidnapping in Boston, he was in character all the way, wearing the same clothes, never said a word. He pled insanity. As far as I know, and I've spoken to several friends who have spoken to him while he's in prison, that he still has not leveled with anybody, as far as I know.
Do you think there's any reason for it? You know, with the research that you've done, as close as anybody can, Mark, you've got to know this guy better than anybody. And at the same time, I'm sure you don't know him at all. Has anybody been able to get close to him? Has he opened up to anybody?
Well, you know, he opened up to people in the various guises that he had, but it was under that constraint. I don't think he's ever said, hey, I'm really a German immigrant from so-and-so. He did to one person. He gave some indication of that, one friend, but then he didn't totally level with him on everything. That's what I understand. I feel that he's still in the charade of it, as far as I know. And I haven't spoken to everyone who's talked to him, obviously, but I'm talking about recently. And, of course, when he was actually in the guise of Clark Rockefeller, he was Clark Rockefeller.
When we deal with somebody like this, and especially if you're a journalist, do you have to become him to really get a handle on putting it to pen?
No, not really. I don't think so, because I interviewed everyone, you know, I did probably 200 interviews of people who knew him in his various guises, including the detectives, the FBI agents, the police who interviewed him after his arrest. That was fascinating. He did, you know, give some indication to them that, you know, he knew who he was and who he really was, but he never really came out and said it. He was still Clark. But as far as I was able to tell the story through the people who knew him, and also through the documents that I was given about his life along the way, there was quite a bit, and I was lucky enough to be given those documents, which painted a picture of him in his various situations.
You know, by the way, what's a little bit scary on the front cover of the book, the fourth picture over it, that doesn't look like Michael Douglas. I don't know who does.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. All of those pictures of him are so different. You're right about that. And, you know, he used glasses and clothing and accents and calling cards. And he really researched the personas he played.
I wonder if there'll be a movie made out of this.
You know, I would hope there would be, but you never know about that. You know, that's a whole different thing. And in writing a book, you just do the best you can, and you keep your fingers crossed that it connects with readers.
But what a phenomenal story! If you were to, well, here, let me ask you this question. I think the answer should be really good with this, and it's a question I'll ask occasionally, and. It doesn't matter whether it's fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, whatever the case may be. When somebody decides to put something to pen, somewhere in the process of the writing, there's that epiphany, there's that aha moment when you begin to realize something about the subject matter that you hadn't thought of before you started. It was that seeing it differently. Where was that for you here?
You know, I think it was when I finally felt that to tell the story, I had to insert myself into it and not just tell it as a third person, you know, kind of distant observer, because I was following his trail. So I think early on it kind of clicked for me with that.
Yeah, and I'm going to go back to before the comment that I made was that you almost have to write about somebody to really experience them, to get it down. You got to become that person for a while. And mm-hmm. you find yourself falling into it. I don't mean going out and kidnapping and killing people, but,
right.
but falling into the mindset. And by falling into the mindset, it really comes out on paper, because I really believe that anybody who's a writer or journalist, you're an artist. An artist puts it on canvas, you put it on words. It's the same thing. You're building, you're creating.
Sure. I mean, I tried to get into his mind. I tried to think, why? Why would he do this? What would he tell this person? You know, and then when I was with the people that he would tell these things to, I tried to imagine him there and what he would say and do. So, yeah, I did my best to get into his mind, and you're right about that. You do more or less act or play, you know, when you're in trying to follow some person and get the essence of them on paper.
Yeah. Obviously, he's in jail right now. How old a man is this?
How old is he now? He's in his 50s now. But when he came here in 78 when he was 17. So what is he in his early, almost 50?
Yeah, okay. I'm sure it was a roller coaster ride that he had, but he's going to spend the rest of his life in a jail cell. So I wonder really if it was worth it. And I would venture to guess if you were to interview him in about 4 or 5 years from now, he'll probably mm-hmm. end up breaking down.
Yeah, you know what? He's the trial hasn't happened for the in California. So that's another thing. Every time I thought I was finished with this book, with this story, something else would happen or somebody else would come out of the woodwork that had another wrinkle to it. And now he was charged with this other case in California on March 15th. So now we have another case and another whole chapter opens.
So that'd be kind of interesting too, the second book, The Man in the Rockefeller Suit, Chapter 2. It's there. By the way, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's just www.mark-seal.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, Mark, can we buy the book there?
Yes, you can. There's links to Amazon and everywhere else.
Wonderful. Hey, Mark Seal, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a lover's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Dresser After Dark. Pamela Hay coming up, Marriage Confidential.
I am sure who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. That's all.
Welcome back. I am Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. Pamela Haig with us, Dr. Pamela Haig. Her work has spanned a wide and unusual spectrum, all the way from academic scholarship to memoir, and it's consisted and focused on women's issues, feminism, American culture, but she's also written on topics as electric as the effect to rebuild the lower Manhattan subway. And that was around 9/11, 24-hour sports radio talk shows, and the experience of class mobility. Pamela, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Marriage Confidential, Post-Romantic Age of Workhorse Wives, Royal Children, Undersex Spouses, and Rebel Couples Who Are Rewriting the Rules. We are rewriting the rules, aren't we?
Yes, I think marriage is in a brainstorming phase right now. I think we're moving out of the romantic patterns and ideals of marriage that were probably in their heyday in the 1950s. So I think marriage is changing really across the board in terms of who we marry, when we marry, why we get married, what we expect, child rearing, really the whole gamut.
You know, if you go back to the 50s, it was a completely different world as far as moms went and marriages went. And I think one of the things that happened was after the Second World War, and they lost so many of their children, they decided to stay home. And when they stayed home, they became moms. Dad went out and did what dad does. And it was kind of a throwback to the, you know, early 1900s and in the 20s. Then came the 60s, and then the 60s was the revolutions and so on and so forth, and we know how it built with the 70s, 80s, 90s. So the definition of marriage today is completely different than it was then, and the amount of divorces are skyrocketing today, and I don't necessarily know if somebody really understands what the word marriage is.
Well, I think that the meaning is changing so much, really. I think that marriages today are much more, well, for one thing, 40% of Americans believe that marriage is becoming obsolete. And that number is actually even higher if you just look at young Americans. So the meanings have definitely changed. But I don't know that marriage is entirely becoming obsolete. I think the divorce rate has stabilized a little, so that's some good news for marriage. But I also just think that the nature of the bond today, it's more like a friendship. You know, I think that we marry people who are much more like us in terms of education and career and life goals and life experiences. And that's completely different from the 1950s model, you know, where there really were very, you know, there's a gender division in marriage. So that's kind of changed the expectation. I think marriage is much more experienced as a friendship than anything else.
Well, we've also redefined the position of a woman in today's society, and men have taken on a little bit of a different position also. So the culture, the society, and the culture has changed drastically in these 40, 50 years, and because of that, we have what we have today. And marriage in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean, you know, this is your lifelong, I give you my life and my promise and my this and my that. It doesn't work that way anymore. And I'm almost sorry that it doesn't, but it doesn't work that way anymore. And it's getting to the point where you realize what it is that you're getting into. If you know what you're getting into, if you can, you have a commonality of definition between the two of you, you got a chance to make it work. If you don't, you're in
right.
trouble.
Well, my book is definitely not an advice book, but I think you're correct that the commonality of definition, that the couple itself understands what they want to get out of their marriage, how they want it to function and what the rules are, is really important. I mean, just looking at breadwinning, there are many ways you could do that today. You could have a stay-at-home dad, you could have a stay-at-home mom, you could have a dual-career couple. But the one thing that I discovered in talking to wives, particularly, is that the couple needs to feel like it's fair for themselves, that each partner is doing enough of that unglamorous work so that it balances out, however that's divided up, you know, whether it means both are working in the workforce or one isn't. There are a lot of marriages where that sense of too much stress and almost too much unfairness in how the work was being allocated, that came up as a real cause of marital semi-happiness, and that can indeed lead to divorce.
Oh, and by the way, that's the trickle-down effect of the children that we have today. You go all the way back, and the 1800s, 1890s, whatever it was, and before then, dad taught the kids, the boys, how to shoot and how to shoot and how to do this and do that and ride horses, and the girls were they were taught to how to cook, how to do this, how to do that. As we got older and the advent of the automobile, the train, the automobile, etc., they were going farther and farther away from home. In the old days, it was mom and dad taught survival skills. The kids don't get survival skills from mom and dad today. They get it from school. They get it from the, you know, technology, etc., etc. So everything that you're talking about here has an effect on how those children are going to be out in the world when they get old enough to participate.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're picking up survival skills probably on the internet more than anything else today, or I'm not. I mean, child rearing has changed a great deal. I think that, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, children were more sort of a part of the family, and pretty much they were there, and they, you know, I remember the children's table. Children sat at their table when company came over, and grown-ups had their worlds, and it was a little more nonchalant. I mean, I think a lot of marriages today are much more defined on being a helicopter parent and being very, very involved in supervising of the children's lives. And in some ways, that might be hurting marriages more than it's helping children.
Sure, and supervision in and of itself, you don't, as no, I'm not a parent of today, but a parent of today has got a little bit of a problem because I think they're hamstrung. I think their hands are tied behind their back because there are too many interventions from the government, from school, so on and so forth, that doesn't allow parents to say, this is right and this is wrong. And if you step on the street, we're going to whack you on your behind. You can't do that today. So there's no consequence. So you've got a very interesting place with the parents separating in their own way and the kids growing up so independent of the parents, and they know more than the parents. It's a very confusing time for youngsters.
That there's certainly a lot of changes going on. Yeah, I mean, it's my own son's childhood is very different than mine, just because of even just the technology. How much that's a big part of his life. But.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's focus though on core. The core message of the book. I pick the book up. I read it page, and I have it in front of me. I pick it up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, walk away with that he did not have? How am I going to look at things, my perspective, that I didn't have before I read the book?
You're going to get the big picture view of how marriage is changing, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, out of the 20th century into this new millennium. So you're going to get the big picture of kind of the quirky and curious and interesting ways that real-life couples, as opposed to celebrity couples, are marrying, how they're doing marriage, what their experiences are, what their expectations are. So I'm really kind of covering the gamut of everything involved in a marriage, career, money, child rearing, sex, the whole thing.
What caused you?
And my premise is that we are moving into a post-romantic age that will become more defined as the century progresses.
No question. Well, what was it that caused you to take a look at this? What was it that triggered you, that sparked you to research it and put it to pen?
Well, I was really, you know, I was trained as an historian, so I was very interested in the big picture and the big canvas of just taking stock of what had happened to marriage for my generation. You know, having been born in the late 60s, having grown up in the 70s, and then been an adolescent in the 80s. And then I was also interested in the marriages that I saw around me, which seemed, you know, best described as semi-happy. You know, there was a certain wistfulness. It wasn't just, you know, we all know that no marriage is all fun and games or happiness, but there was a real sense of, this isn't quite the marriage I thought I was going to have. So I wanted to explore that. I wanted to look at why that would be happening. So I was really interested in all of the marriages around me, and then I was also really interested in the historical big picture.
If the perfect marriage for you, you and I meet, we like each other, we decide we want to get married. What's the perfect marriage for you?
Well, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that anymore. I mean, when I look back on my mother's marriage, there was really one way that marriage was defined, and even the wedding ceremonies were very similar. I mean, all the brides wore white gowns and gave out Jordan almonds as a favor, and that was very much our experience, and my parents are still married. Today, if you go to weddings, you're likely to see weddings that are very personalized, you know, for the couple's personality, you know, so it'll reflect their hobbies or their values or their beliefs. And I think that one of the big trends is that marriage is changing just in the way that wedding ceremonies are, and that they're going to be getting more customized to what couples want it to be. So it would be really hard to define an ideal. But, you know, for me, some of the basics are always that you have a sense of respect for each other and honesty, and you try to enjoy each other's company and friendship, and you share the load. I think those are some pretty basic qualities of a marriage.
I saw something very interesting about, when was it, 10, 12 years ago. My ex-wife was a marathon runner, and we went up to the university where we were at the time to get, She couldn't go. She asked me to go up to the university to get her number for the run. And I'm standing in front of the table, and there's two young women sitting behind the table, couldn't be more than 18, 19 years old at the most, obviously university students, young ones. And I said, I'm here for my, I'm here for my wife's bib or number. And they both looked at me and they said, what do you mean my wife? You don't own her. I said, okay, I'm here for her stuff. And then I listened to them talk. And I got to tell you, Pamela, I had to sit back and think about this. One of them is saying, my person's going to come over and we're going to go have lunch together. My person. And it's almost a loss.
I've never heard that phrase. I thought I'd heard them all.
Yeah.
My person?
Yeah, my person.
It wasn't their partner?
No, it's person. I heard it 2-3 times. Specifically got that. That's why I remembered it. And I thought,
well, that's a new one to me.
Yeah.
I hear partner a lot. I hear life partner, yes. Co-parent. I mean, at times it does sound a bit like a corporation.
Yeah, but the person was non-gender. And I think that's where they were going with that. And I think a lot of the problems that we're having in marriages today, that people are, they don't quite understand what they are anymore based on the definition that they're given them.
Well, I think that they can still improvise really great marriages where they fulfill the roles that work best for them and that work best together. I don't believe that we need to go back to the very gendered division of labor of the 1950s, you know, to see marriage survive. I mean, that had serious problems as well.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think there's been a lot of progress since then, but, you know, it does require more work to figure out how you're going to divide things up in a marriage and who's going to do what. You do need to be a little thoughtful about that.
Oh, no question about it. I don't think that people actually sit down, for the most part now, in general, sit down for the most part and find out what they're getting into. Find out what it is with the other person. Does anybody say, okay, you and I meet and we decide to go out, we like each other, but would you think that somebody would say, how do you receive love? Nobody asks that question. We're supposed to know how the other person receives it, and we don't, because we think we do. And we can only go from our own personal perspective. And if the other person receives it differently, you're never giving them anything through the period of time that you're with them, and they're going to leave. Why are they going to leave? Because you don't love them. What do you mean I don't love you? You don't show me. How can I show you if I don't know how you receive it? And I think it's very important for people to sit down today, if they're going to get into a relationship, to say, how do you receive it? How do you like to be kissed? Da, da, da. And you move through that, you get your answers, then you can decide whether or not you want to move farther.
Right. And also, it's important to revisit what's going on in the marriage in a concerted way, because you take vows at one point in your life and you want the marriage to adapt and evolve. I interviewed a couple that rewrote their marriage vows, revisited their marriage vows every few years, because they wanted them to actually be up to date with real things that were happening and real challenges in their lives. And I mean, I think that's just a good marital habit that any marriage could benefit from.
Oh, Pamela, I thought there was somebody who was on the show some years back, and I remember they were talking about being in a relationship, and what the two of them did was on Sunday night, every Sunday night, they don't care if they were yelling and screaming at each other, at 7 o'clock they stopped and kissed.
That's sweet.
Yeah. It was a reaffirmation of who they were. Get beyond the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and promise that
it's good that they were taking some time to do something that was about the two of them. Which I think, you know, again, my book's not an advice book, but, you know, therapists always point that out. That, you know, the marriage can't get swallowed up in chores and in the child rearing and all of the other stressful activities.
You mean marriage is not like Doris Day and Rock Hudson?
I think that's a relief.
way back when, yeah.
You're going back, yeah.
By the way, what kind of feedback are you getting about the book?
Oh, I've been happy with it. It seems to elicit interest. I think that I'm trying to show a big picture, you know, of what's going on in marriage, and marriage is still very hidden. You know, we said that we're this society that talks about everything and has no sense of privacy, but I think that these issues of marital feelings and misgivings, you know, they're often very hidden. I think people enjoy being able to read a book, you know, with stories and with other examples and insights. So I've been pleased. I had some good reviews. It just came out, though, so.
Let me tell you what I like about the book, and I have it in front of me. What I like about the book, basically, is this. It lays out, I haven't read it yet, but as we're talking, I'm going through it. It lays out the dynamic of what occurs in today's world with a marriage, if you're going to be married, etc. And if somebody's going to get into it, they should have some kind of an edge, some kind of information about what they're walking into. That, in and of itself, saves marriages.
I agree. I hope that someone would read this book before they get married and before they get divorced, because they might say, well, maybe I can work on things. Maybe I'm not alone. So I think it would be good to read at either end of the spectrum. Thank you.
Yeah, and there's so many people who put, you know, they put brilliant books together, and there are certain books that I think that should go into the schools. It should go into either late in high school or very early on in college, because what happens is we get, you know, academic education, then you get out on the street, and there is a difference between knowledge and wisdom. The wisdom is when you get out there and you get knocked on your whatever and you get back up again and you keep moving forward. This is in these kind of books is the wisdom. That's what I think is lacking in our educational system today. That bridge, that one step to how to put everything that you've learned to practical use.
Mm-hmm. It's a very tough thing to learn. You know, experience is probably the best teacher for that.
Yeah, I know, but you could have a class and then you could find somebody and be in a relationship with them for 2-3 years and you say, okay, I'm done, grade me, and I'm off to the next one. No good.
Well, I love the idea of it being read in classes as a primer. That's a great idea.
I got it. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. Let's see. I have a personal website, which is www.pamelahaig.com. And there's also a friend of mine put together a book site. So that's www.marriagecompetential.com.
Wonderful.
And you could probably order the book from either site as well.
That was the question I was going to ask. So we can get the book on either site. Wonderful. Okay, Pamela, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time, and the book is great.
Yes, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Hopefully, Kelly Dorfman is with us. The book is What's Eating. Oh, good. Thank you, Kelly. I'm going to applaud. They didn't say you. The little angel that floats around the control room didn't say you were here. Okay, let me do this great intro, okay? Kelly Dorfman is here. The book is What's Eating Your Child? The Hidden Connection Between Food and Childhood Ailments, Anxiety, Recurrent Ear Infections, Stomach Aches, Picky Eating, Rashes, ADHD, and so much more, and what every parent can do about it. Kelly, just the title alone, I think, is absolutely brilliant, because there are too many people who do not realize what you take in causes what you are.
Absolutely.
Now, where was it for you that you first got a hold of looking at this in such a way that you wanted to put it to pen? Where was it? Where was the light bulb that said, I've got to research this?
Well, I think I started even when I was in college studying nutrition, and I realized there was a lot of lip service about how nutrition was important, but when it came down to applying it at the real world level, like if you had a headache or if you had reflux or problems, there didn't seem to be a lot of information available. So I decided I want my career to be about helping people come up with creative solutions for these kind of problems and seeing where nutrition could fit into that picture.
Now, by the way, your specialty is in finding nutritional solutions to common ailments. And I think the key there is understanding what food is for the most part. We are nothing more than an electrochemical factory. And what you put in your mouth ends up to be a chemical anyway, and it's going to either do something good or something bad to your body.
Right. Food is medicine. You might be taking medicine, but everything you eat is some form of medicine.
And no, absolutely. So then everything that we eat based on what is in that food is going to cause us to feel good, not to feel good, to break out or have great skin. And most people have no concept that this is even the natural food. It's just, it's available to you, but it's knowing what to look out for and what not to eat. And I think that's really what the key is.
Right. And that's why I set up the book in series of detective cases so people could see how to think about it. They could follow you step by step while you were thinking through a case, just like watching CSI on TV. And then there's a section on how to apply this to your own situation and whether it applies to help people, again, to put application to the theory.
And I wonder how many people or how many parents that are running, their kids are running around, they have all of these ear infections and they're spending just mega bucks at the doctor's office and don't realize that it's caused by food allergies. And I think the big problem here is going to a medical doctor, and with all due respect, if they don't have the expertise, if they don't have the specialty in the particular area, they're going to miss it.
Oh, and I'm so glad you brought up ear infections, Michael, because that's one of the strongest correlations between diet and a condition, because there was a study done in Washington, D.C., and they found 90% of recurring ear infections and ear fluid were related to food sensitivities. And when the food sensitivity was taken out and the ear infections went away and went back in, they came back.
Now, by the way, also, and I want to touch on this too, you've got those 10 fascinating facts about children's diets. People don't realize it's the picky eating. You know, it could be reducing the child's capacity to learn. It has an effect on their ability to take in and perceive what's presented to them.
Right. Because, like you said, you're a bag of chemicals, and your brain is part of that bag of chemicals, and you're building it in the utero when you're inside your mother, but you're also building it with the food you're eating when you're outside. And they've done numerous studies. Fat, in particular, has a tremendous impact on brain development because the brain is 60 to 70% fat. So the kind of fat you eat can dramatically affect how your brain functions.
Oh, okay, all right. So based on the kind of fat that you eat, does the brain store the fat?
Well, yes, the brain is fat. The brain is 60 to 70% fat. So the kind of fat you eat is like what kind of brick you're using to build the wall, which is, in this case, is your brain. And so they found that the kind of fats that are in fish, for example, 25% of your brain is one type of fat called DHA, which is found in fish and also found in seaweed. And you can make that fat from good fats, but the kind of fats that are found in processed food and boxed foods don't convert to DHA. And so you just literally won't have the material to make the kind of brain that you need.
And now, by the way, another thing, I want to move to this, which is extremely important. We keep hearing fiber, 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 so your bowel movements can be natural. You're saying too much fiber can have a reverse effect on you.
Especially on children, because if you're having trouble pushing out poop, which quite frankly is a muscular thing because you're squeezing
to a process called peristalsis. You're squeezing the poop along the digestive tract, and that takes the muscle control. So for some kids who are having trouble with that, if you stuff it up with more fiber, it makes it even harder to push the poop out. So it would be like going to the gym and saying, I'm in bad shape, and then having the gym person say, well, I guess you need 10 extra pounds of weight, rather than taking it easy till you get in better shape and get those muscles developed.
You know, by the way, one thing I think is very interesting to touch on here, and I'm going to take an offshoot of it. The short stature, the poor growth, could be caused by a zinc deficiency.
Yes, because zinc is actually a nutrient you need to create growth hormone.
Okay, now, by the way, let's talk about, I'm going to talk about calcium for a moment. In the beginning of the year, I got a cold, and the cold developed into pneumonia, which developed into bronchial pneumonia. All right, I got through that. Everything was fine. And then when that was going away, all of a sudden I got constipated. And in addition to that is I couldn't think, couldn't sleep at night, couldn't breathe. I mean, there was a myriad of things going on with me. And I had lost, I've been a bodybuilder all my life, and I don't weigh a lot, but for me, if I lose 20 pounds, a lot of my muscle mass just went right down the tubes. So within about a month or so, I looked like I was walking deaf. People who knew me were afraid that they should, you know, leave me alone by myself and stick me in the hospital.
That's terrible.
when I went to the doctor's office and they did some blood tests, what it turned out, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. Kelly, it was an overload of calcium. And to this day, I don't know how that happened. But something like calcium, too much calcium, I can't believe the symptoms and what it did to me. So effectively, what you eat and what you bring in will cause what's there. Now, by the way, I'm back in action again, and I got 12 of that 20 pounds back on me, so that's coming rapidly. But the point of contention is that you're absolutely spot on. If you're not eating right, the things that can happen to you, and there are many people who would have no idea that this is what would have caused it.
Right. And, of course, you had a lot of events and puzzle pieces to put together to come to that conclusion.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, no question about it. But the idea is that, you know, for me, something like that, it's like I'm sick. Okay, let's fix this thing, and I'm going to go find out what it is, which I ended up doing. But there's so many people, it's like the doctor said, I wanted to sleep all the time. And he said, there are people who go to sleep, they don't wake up from this. So I thought, okay, I got to do something here.
And well, it's good you had a detective mindset, which is what I'm trying to help parents and caretakers develop, so that you don't just take no for an answer or we don't know, but you keep on digging and asking questions and being curious until you find the answer. And hopefully nutrition is something that you put in your pile of possibilities.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Now, eating more fish has been associated with lower levels of depression. And there are so many people running around today that are depressed. And what that's telling me is depression is effectively could be from a response from a chemical reaction.
Yes. And again, we're back to fats and brain development. And they found that the kind of fats that you eat affect the way the brain operates and sends signals around. And so the kind of fat that's found in fish helps to change the signaling, and it moves it towards less depression and less anxiety, too. And these studies were done at Harvard.
By the way, one other thing, choline, which not too many people would even know what that was or have heard the word, essential nutrient. Few people know about the deficiency, what can happen.
Yes, choline is one of my favorite nutrients, and partly because it's obscure. But the reason that many people don't know about choline is because, Michael, it was only discovered to be vital in 1998, which is not too long ago. And in order to be a vital nutrient, there has to be a deficiency syndrome they can find. Like in vitamin C, if you don't have enough vitamin C, your gums bleed, for example. But in choline, they couldn't figure out what it was. And it turned out the deficiency symptom was a reduced capacity to learn.
You know, by the way, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do here. On your PR, your press release things, it's 10 fascinating facts about children's diets. And then on the back of it, it says Nutrition Sleuthing 101, all right? The symptom, the possible cause. This is going up on the refrigerator. Forget the kids. I'm going to use it.
That's terrific,
but realistically, when we come down to it, this is the same thing for an adult, isn't it?
Oh, it is the same thing. And I have a lot of adult clients, and sometimes they bring their kids in. Sometimes the kids come in, and we go backwards up through the parents. But absolutely, this is not by any means just a childhood situation. It just happens that this was the place we started, but these things can all be applied to adults.
Oh, no, I'm looking at these things, and I'm thinking that, my goodness, if you have this sitting on the refrigerator, you know, the Nutrition Sleuthing 101, and if you look at like one, you know, a symptom, gastrointestinal distress, including stomach aches, diarrhea, and gas, possible symptom, intolerance of gluten, the protein found in wheat, possible solution, remove foods that contain gluten from the diet, simple city. But you have to know that before you can do it.
Yes, and so before you jump to medicines, which will always be there, and there's nothing, you know, wrong with taking medicine when it's appropriate, but perhaps you want to look at the chemicals you're putting in your body first before adding new ones.
Okay, well, let's talk.
That's what the whole point of the book is.
Let's talk amino acids and anxiety. Do you have to have a certain amount of aminos to be able to function properly?
Right. And for your viewers who don't know what amino acids are, they're the building blocks of protein.
Absolutely. So where do we get the amino acids?
Well, amino acids are found in many foods, but they're basically parts of protein, so they're found more plentifully in foods that are full of protein.
Okay, so in essence, too, I'm going to say this, and we'll break down what this really means. The neurotransmitters. Most neurotransmitters are made from amino acids. Tyrosine became the neurotransmitter dopamine. And tryptophan can be used to build serotonin. Now, that may be a language that most people have no idea what that means, but at the same time, if you break down what they are and what they do and how to improve on that which you need, my goodness, look at the billions of dollars we wouldn't have to spend on doctors every day.
Right. And so, for example, if you wanted to increase tryptophan in your diet, you would eat more complex carbohydrates. And they found that in a complex carbohydrate-rich diet, you absorb more of the amino acid tryptophan. And if you want tyrosine to go up and so you can increase dopamine, you increase your protein, so it's a heavier protein diet, and then those amino acids are more dominant. So there's a lot of manipulation you can do to get the result that you want.
Now, interesting. So what we're saying is that if you're intentional with your body, the results that you want, you'll end up getting. If you just accidentally let things flow through, you're in trouble. I'll tell you how to get a real quick flash of dopamine. Smile.
Yeah,
no, I'm serious. You know, the whole thing about, you know, the smiling, laughter is the best medicine. When you laugh, you release the dopamine, makes you feel good, calms you down. And you've heard people, many times they say, laugh, smile, do something. I don't know if they know the reason behind it, but that's just exactly what it is. If you smile, you release it rapidly. So there's so many things that you can do if you know what to do and how your body and your mind and your emotions are going to react to what you put in your body.
Yeah, and if you're a neurotransmitter junkie, which I don't understand, I love learning about this stuff, an obscure neurotransmitter you may not know as much about is called acetylcholine. And guess what? That's made from the nutrient choline. And acetylcholine has to do with motor planning and executive functioning. So it has to do with how you think through things and how you prioritize your thinking. That has a lot to do with ADD and with language development.
No, absolutely. It also has to do with how you hear, how you listen, and how you respond, because it's the same thing. A word can have the same chemical reactions as the food you put into your mouth. Based on what you hear, that word will bring up an unconscious emotion tied to an experience, and you've got a chemical change in your body. So no matter what you do, whether it's food or what you're watching, what you're listening to, it is your body's chemicals that are going to change. If you know what it takes to change them, you could really have a nice life.
And there's many roads to Rome, as you're saying. You can do it with food, and that helps. You can do it with thoughts, and that helps. And sometimes you need to do it with all of it.
Oh, I think all the time you need to do it with all of it. I mean, there's got to be that homeostasis. You've got to have that balance. And I think it's the balance that causes us to be or not to be who we are in life and those attitudes and who we're dealing with. You know, very interesting. Think about it this way. You and I are married. You're not eating the right food. And for some reason, you eat something that's going to trigger a little bit of depression, that's going to trigger some anxiety, and now you're just a little edgy and nervous. I walk in and I say, hi. Well, guess what, Kelly? I'm going to get nailed. You're going to come right after me because of what you ate or what you didn't eat. I wonder how many arguments and fights wouldn't happen if you didn't eat or ate the right things.
And I think that that's true with kids, too. I saw a child recently, and the mother told me after we straightened out her diet, she was so much easier to love. And, of course, that's a very startling thing to say, but it's also a very sad thing because she was trying to be a good, loving mother, and she found her daughter difficult to love when she was behaving like a crazy person, eating the wrong foods.
Yeah, now, by the way, wrong foods, et cetera, we've heard so much about supplements, and I think supplements are one of the most important things that we can have, because by the time your food gets to your table, a tremendous amount of the nutrients are gone. If you have digestive problems, by the time that it goes through that digestive tract, you're not getting the full value of what that food could have been. So supplements are extremely important. But how do you find the right ones? How do you choose the right ones?
Well, there's definitely an art to that. And if, of course, if you ever get stuck, there's no reason why you can't get additional help, because we can't expect everybody to be a nutritional expert. But I think that supplements are very useful because they provide some insurance between what you're hoping to be eating or what you plan to be eating and what you actually eat, for one thing. And then also, like you say, medications, environmental stressors, emotional stress also can take a toll on nutrition.
Oh, and absolutely. And if you really want to know what it is, go to your local doctor and get a blood test.
Or find a nutritionist who knows about nutrition and can give you some advice based on your individual situation. We don't always have great blood tests for everything you might need. For example, people taking statin drugs need more coenzyme Q10, which is sort of an obscure antioxidant. So that might be something that you would know about just because you were taking a certain medication. So there's all kinds of little bits of information like that.
And CoQ10 is good for the heart,
yes.
Ginkgo biloba is good for the brain. It's and it depends on what you're doing and what you take. And if you're taking them and they're not working, find something else. Or if you're having an adverse reaction, find something close to it. Because I really believe it works this way. And I'm not a nutritionist and I'm not a clinician, so I'm going to be a little off with this, but the example will be there. Let's say I had a shortage of iron, so I'm recommended to take B12. So I take the B12, and yet I'm still not getting the iron. Well, maybe there is something else in addition to the B12 that I would have to take to make sure that it goes to the spot where I want it. So instead of going into my bloodstream, the B12 might be absorbed in my skin. But if I had the other nutrient that went with it, it would make sure that it went to the right spot. So it's also the combination that's going to get what you want.
I'm glad you brought that up. I think the combination is important. And the other thing is that people are concerned that they're going to have a bad reaction, and that means that things are not going well. But sometimes bad reactions are important information about how your body metabolizes things so you can make the right decision. Some of the best cases I've seen have started off with unusual reactions to things that have given us clues about how that individual's chemistry operates so we can make very good decisions about how to help them better.
No, absolutely. And my brunch, my breakfast between breakfast and lunch is whey protein with half and half in it with a couple of raw eggs and some wheat germ, and I'm ready to rock. Everybody.
That wouldn't be for everybody, Michael. I'm glad it works for you.
Yeah, I'm not easy to live with. But anyway, okay, let me ask you this. We're running out of time. Do you have, Kelly, do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. The book website is www.whatseatingyourchild.com without any punctuation in it. And that's the best place to read about the book. And the book is available at any bookstore. It's also available as an e-book. And Amazon carries it additionally.
Wonderful. Hey, Kelly Dorfman, and it's What's Eating Your Child. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Spot on. I think this thing is great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Nice talking to you by phone.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Please don't make me dream alone. I beg you, don't you make me dream alone. No, no, I don't want to dream alone. Come on, my darling, don't make me dream.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Don Spinney with us. He's the author of 60 Seconds to Yes and the Pro Force Sales Mastery and Influence Program. He's the number one bestseller, 60 Seconds to Yes. And Don personally conducts over 150 sales training sessions per year, making him the most prolific sales coach in the nation today. Don has been a successful sales professional and sales manager for the past 25 years, focusing primarily on the financial services and corporate insurance industry. Fed up with the poor quality and content of available sales training for his teams, he designed in 1995 what is known today as the Pro Force Sales Mastery and Influence Program. Don, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
And thank you so much for being. Did I pronounce your name correctly, your last name?
You did, yeah. You and my second grade teacher, the only two ever to pronounce it correctly the first time. I appreciate that, too.
I have to give credit where credit was due. It was Radio Susie. I looked at her, and she says, pronounce it this way. I said, yes, ma'am,
she's
I'm
good.
Trained.
She's real good. She's good.
Don, when we talk about sales, what are we talking about? You know, so many people are frightened to death of that word. Let me give you a prime example. Years ago, I did a lot of sales training for radio people, and I remember the way we would do it. We would run an ad in the paper. This was in Fairbanks, Alaska, and it was one of the radio stations. And this was like 1980, 83, 84, right around that area. And we'd run an ad in the paper. We'd get, you know, 15, 16, 17 people that would come in and apply. And I would get everybody together sitting in a room. And the question that I would ask is, I would say, what is a salesperson? What's a salesman? What's a saleswoman? And Don, the answers that I got back, and I'm thinking, why would you want to apply for a job if you think that somebody selling something is no more than a thief, quote unquote? And I couldn't believe some of the answers that I got. So, and they filtered themselves out, and the real people who understood it moved with it. Because if you define sales, it's nothing more than offer and acceptance, period, and that's it. But
right.
but the idea here is, how do you define sales today? How do you get someone, and especially in the world we're living in today with the entrepreneurs, they've got a great idea, they got their computer, they're at home making money, but they also have to be able to sell it. How do you define it today?
Absolutely. Before I define it, too, one further step that you hit on that was key. Not only is there a bad perception of sales out there, which is, by the way, the highest paying profession in the world, we're so ashamed of sales in this world, Michael Ray, that we have to come up with fancy names to disguise it, like entrepreneur and consultant and, you know, executive. There's a stigma, and the reason it's so difficult, and there's that stigma out there, and why people struggle with this, and as you know, 99% of salespeople still don't succeed, is when they're in a sales situation, for most people, it feels totally unnatural. You know, all the stuff that we've been taught, we go out there and we, you know, in every other aspect of our life, we're very influential, which is the key. It's influence. Like you said, it's not sales. But for some reason, when a salesperson gets in front of a buyer or a prospect, it feels totally unnatural because basically they're taught to work against nature. And I think that's why there's so much massive failure out there, that they're going against the natural process that you and I have in us that's been around for thousands of years, and that's the process of making a decision. And now, these entrepreneurs, and, you know, what I believe is that entrepreneurship is actually going to solve the economic woes of this country. Small businesses are going to be the solution, not large corporations no longer the solution. But like you said, these people are going to business with the wrong mindset. They don't get that selling is the engine that drives every single business. And that's the last thing that not only they focus on, but they invest in.
Well, by the way, Don, let me add something to that. And before I do, it's the engine for every business, because when it comes to selling, offer, compromise, influence, it starts out with the CEO, CFO, COO, whoever it is that's in charge, that sells an idea or concept to the subordinates who sell the idea or the concept. So it goes on every day. If somebody's married out there, if you're a man and you say to your fiance, to who you love, you say, "Will you marry me?" She's going to say yes or no. She said yes, she sold. If she says no, you didn't do it. So, but I think the real key here is, and this is what I believe, and that what I've learned over a period of years, most people, no matter how sophisticated they are, don't know what they're selling.
Very good. Very true. Spot on. Yeah. Spot on.
Yeah,
absolutely
no question.
True.
I could go on with that, but go ahead.
Yeah, you know, you're right. You know, people are, you keep selling my program for me. Influence is 24/7, and that everybody is always in a situation where they're trying to influence others, or others are trying to influence them. And you know what you said about someone asking somebody to get married, and you know me talking to my spouse. The people that come through our program, we have couples coming to our program, knowing that it's not sales training, but that influence truly is 24/7. You know, that's just, it's a profound statement, yet it goes completely unnoticed by most people. And I just, you know, you're absolutely spot on with that.
Let me add something to this when we talk about, and I think everybody who's out there should listen to this very closely, that when I say that they don't know what they're selling, and an example I've used for years and years and years now is very simple. The scenario is you're doing a project at home. You want a hole in the wall. So you go to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. The question is, and I'm not asking you, but the question is, are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? 90% of everybody says, "I'm buying the drill." The answer to that question is the difference between capturing 90% of an audience or 10% of an audience, because you are not buying the drill. You're buying what the drill can do for you. And the drill and the hole, I think, is the bridge beyond features and benefits, because it is the perceived value of every individual personally out there. And when somebody gets in front of somebody and they're nervous, they are selling the drill. If they understood they were selling the hole, can you imagine the amount of sales that would have happened?
Absolutely. And I don't know where you got that analogy. I've used that exact analogy. If that's yours, I'm going to have to start giving you credit for it. You're 100%
right.
No,
I got it either. I have no idea where I got it.
But Michael Ray, that is 100% true. You know, people are selling products, services, and ideas, and people, unfortunately, do not buy product, services, or ideas. You know, they buy benefits, and they buy what exists in the subconscious mind, and that is to satisfy needs and wants. And more deeply and more specifically to satisfy needs. But you're right, people out there selling stuff, and unfortunately people don't buy stuff. So that's the massive disconnect, and that's why there's so much massive failure, not just in sales, but in business and in communication in general. You're right on.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm down my thought, but you're absolutely correct that people do not understand that, you know, what people buy, there's three macro benefits to every product, service, or idea. And that is time, that is money, and that is the prevention of fear or the gaining of comfort and pleasure. And that those are the only things that are truly for sale in every product, service, or idea. And, you know, but if you're selling mechanical devices and you're selling drills, you know, you're going to lose. If you're selling the love of your daughter because you're building a playhouse with that drill, you're going to win.
That's the entire key. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that if you had a brick and mortar business and somebody walked in to inquire about what you had to offer, one of two things are going to happen. Don, you're going to sell it or you're going to talk them out of it. One of the two.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And talk them out of it. You know, that there's a misconception out there too, Mike Ray. What people do in sales and in business in general, just not just in business in general, is that the way you get people to say yes is you talk, you present, you probe and present. And there's so much overwhelming evidence that that doesn't work and has never worked. But short of nothing else, that's all they do. And that influence, the ultimate influence, is to say nothing and have people come and flock to you and be a center of influence. So the opposite of influence is talking. And the more the seller talks, the less effective they are. But again, they just don't know what else to do. All they can do is practice presentations, practice and study their product, and hope that by talking, I'll get people to say yes. And if they don't, I'll just have to talk to a lot more people. You can't acquire wealth. You can't make 10 times more money working 10 times more hours. There's no leverage in that. But short of anything else, they don't know what else to do.
Oh, no question. I think one of the big problems that we have out today, and especially today, you've got a brand new consumer out there. It's a net generation. They buy differently than other people have bought. If I want a car today, Don, I can go to my computer. I can hit a button and I can go to beepbeep.com or any number of websites that will give me every car that is on every car lot and the price and the breakdown and the Carfax and the rest of it. We have a very wise consumer out there. And I think in and of itself that anybody who is in any kind of marketing has got to realize that consumer, because the old days of selling are over with. People don't like to be sold anymore, but we still love to buy. And if they can be reached in a way that they understand what you mean by what you say, and you've got all of these first generations growing up in the digital age now, and you've got to be able to collaborate. The customer today has got to be invested in your business. They've got to be part of it. They've got to be part of them helping themselves make the decision.
Absolutely. You know, one of the strange things that people don't realize when they're in business or they're in sales, and again, the evidence is overwhelming, but the biggest decisions that you and I have made in our lives and everybody, the decision to get married and have children, to move, to change jobs, to start a business, the biggest decisions we've made in our life, we did so without a salesperson. We don't need salespeople to make decisions. We're very good at it as a species. It's one of our primary, it is our primary function is to make decisions. So the salesperson that understands that process, understands the decision process, and that there is no selling process is going to win. And you know, the fact that you just said, people can go out and they're smarter, they can make their own decisions, they do all the research. They came to the salesperson ready to buy, and the salesperson loses them. You know, they were in the decision process. That means you're there to say yes to something. The salesperson loses them. Why? Well, they're talking. They're presenting. They're talking down to them, and they're probing and presenting and raising defenses. And the educated buyer doesn't go for that anymore.
No, they're talking at them and not to them. There's a big difference. And I think another example of the drill in the hole, the quote, the feature, the benefit, and the whatever, and I've asked this time and again, when with men, and you would say, you know, when you married your wife, did you marry who she is or did you marry how she made you feel? And it's the how she made you feel, because there could be 10 women standing there, and that one special one is going to make you feel a certain way. You didn't marry her. You married how she made you feel, which caused you to be emotionally satisfied. And at the bottom, at base, there's got to be that recognition of the possibility of emotional satisfaction for making the decision. Otherwise, you lose the decision.
Absolutely. You know, it's cliche to say you buy on emotion and then you justify and validate with logic. And again, what failure to understand that the emotional part, the emotional connection, is why people say yes to anything. Failure to understand that and to navigate that effectively is a killer in sales. And, you know, the logic part, that's where you and I as salespeople get to present. That doesn't get anybody to buy. They've already made the decision emotionally before that. We just either talk them out of it or they just work through our horrible presentation. But buy on emotion, that emotional connection, as you mentioned there with the wife example, that is, again, dead spot on.
Sure, and what I think what's necessary also is not for somebody to understand what you're saying. And this is, Don, this is also in presentation also. It's not for somebody to understand, it's to recognize what you're saying. If you recognize something that somebody has to say, it becomes part of you. If I can't recognize myself in your presentation, for the most part, you've lost me. I've got to be able, there's a sense of human involvement, participation that has to go on also. Are you familiar with a somatic marker? Okay, yeah, it's that triggers, that emotional bookmark. It's that it connects your experiences to specific emotions. And I think one of the most brilliant things that anybody ever did, and the major advertisers do it, they set those markers up. That's what all those ads that drive you to make buying decisions are about. The markers are strategically placed to trigger predetermined responses. I think the best one would be the that Nutrisystem ad. You get a woman who's overweight, and then you have a woman who's lost the weight, and the woman who's smiling. That smile says it all. That's going to hit an emotion, and that somatic marker is going to pop up. You're going to recognize something that you can say, oh, I can do that. That'll fix it. And that moment of the dopamine rush is when the decision is made. And that, most people had better start getting. Otherwise, they're going to lose it, and they should go out and become a plumber.
Problem is, they're still going to have to sell, even as a plumber. You know, you said
too.
It there too. Though you said a critical point too. You know, it just when you think about the sales people, the people that influenced you and I the most. What is it about them that got us to say yes or to be influenced by them? If you really analyze it, they weren't talking about them. They made it all about you and I, and they were not important in that encounter. And you know that, and when you talk about those, the advertisers, again, proof that you don't need a human being to buy. The advertising does the same thing. The advertising that you're talking about navigates people through their natural decision process, hitting the key points that we hit in that decision process without the help of a salesperson. And you know, again, it's simple and it's as easy, and the brain function that operates this is easy. But again, not knowing how to do it, it doesn't matter how easy it is; they're going to struggle.
And also to understand that there's a dynamic, there's a science behind words. And when you begin to understand the dynamic of what occurs when somebody's listening to what you have to say or what they're watching something, that makes all the difference in the world also. It's become a point where the advent of neurosciences, quote unquote, has a lot to do with the ability for one person to communicate with another person and be persuasive. Because if you don't understand that dynamic of what puts a person together, for the most part, you're not going to be able to reach that person.
Oh, absolutely. You almost gave a commercial for our program. Our program is all about the neuroscience of the buyer, not about the seller. And, you know, most programs are about the seller. Here's what you do. Here's what you say. No, none of that has ever been effective. When you do what you just said, when you understand the neuroscience of the buyer and what's going on in the subconscious mind where this decision process exists, you are so far ahead of the game. I mean, that's just it. Again, you know, it just amazes me, though. You know, you can tell this to people, but they turn around, and what do? They start talking and presenting. You know, you could say it today in front of somebody, and 5 minutes later they're out there presenting and scratching their head, wondering why they struggle. And in all aspects, I'm talking about, you know, you can't, like my wife, I cannot talk my wife into anything. And the key word there is I can't talk my wife into anything. And, you know, if it's not her idea or her decision, which is natural, then she's going to resist and have high defenses. So influence is to get her to believe it's her idea and have it be good for her and have her thank me for guiding her through that decision. But
let me give it to you another way, and we're going to say the same exact thing. There was a woman that I talked to some months ago, and what she was talking about, her subject matter was healthcare, and she would say, well, when you assume this, then that happens and you have a problem here, and you assume that, etc. The moment that you confront someone, even on a minor basis, there is an entire process that goes on and the defense is up. And the moment that the defense is up, there's nothing that you can say to get through that defense. It's a chemical reaction, happens rapidly. Now, if you talk about someone else who made an assumption that caused them this, then they can see it from the outside and realize that maybe that's not a good thing for them to do. It's bypassing those natural mechanisms that cause us to be or not to be, to stand up and fight or run away.
It's like you wrote my book, you know, that confrontational thing about how the defenses go up when someone is confronted. is it's a killer in sales. One of the strange things about that, Michael Ray, is that people don't realize that when a person's in conflict resolution, for example, in the sales world, we call that maybe objections. When they're in conflict resolution, and when we jump in there with them, even to try to solve a problem, when two people are in conflict resolution, no matter how helpful we're trying to be, that's called a fight.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they're confronted, their defenses go up, and we have a statement. When their defenses are high, they do not buy. When their defenses are high, they say no. And it's very easy to trigger that confrontation and that defense mechanism somebody inadvertently. Even when you're trying to help, you can trigger that mechanism. It's very fascinating, a very fascinating study.
You know, and it all goes back to the markers that we talked about. Here, a prime example. I was, 7, 8 years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror and I'm playing cowboys. I got my hat on, cap guns. I'm screaming, yelling, having the greatest time. And my dad came in and he laughed at me. I've told the story a million times. And as an 8-year-old, 7-year-old, it shut me off. I would play in front of the mirror again, but he never did it again out loud. As an adult, I understand this. But as a teenager, you didn't talk down to me and you didn't laugh at me. It was that unconscious recognition of something, of a memory, causing a reaction in me right now. Now, that can be used both ways. You can do that where you're in a sales presentation. There's an offer that you want to make someone. If they recognize something in what you've said that can help them fix a problem that they have or that they don't know that they have, that's the difference today. And I think that if they are afraid of the word sell, use another word. But when it really comes down to it, that's really what it is. If I know how to talk to you or you know how to talk to me, you truly know and you understand the dynamic of what occurs once I hear the words that you say, then you couldn't give me a greater gift, Don.
Absolutely. You know, you said, if you know how to talk to me, that is the key. What most people know how to do is talk about themselves.
Yeah.
If you know how to talk to me, you have my attention, you have my interest, you have my low defenses, and now I'm listening. But that that's a skill, Michael, right? That's a skill to talk to you. To be able to talk to you effectively is a learnable skill. Now, that's the whole thing. That's it. It's the conversation before the presentation. That's where influence and sales actually happens. That's where the whole world of business lives, is the conversation before the presentation. The presentation becomes secondary once they have high interest and the person knows how to communicate effectively to them.
Now, by the way, Don, we're running out of time, but one of the greatest rules that I've ever learned in my entire life, and it's this. It's called never sell the way you buy. People buy for their reasons. They don't buy for our reasons. And I've listened to people talk to themselves, sell to themselves, present to themselves for years and years and years without even an idea that an audience or one person sitting across from them thought differently than they did, and have said time and again, don't change. Be who you are. You're great who you are. But when you're dealing with an audience or you're dealing with somebody on the opposite side of that table, step outside yourself. You have to think the way they think, because if you don't, you're talking to a wall.
Wonderful advice. That's a beautiful way to end the interview. Again, it's like you should be teaching my program. I mean, you're obviously very experienced at this, but you and I think exactly the same. That's wonderful. Wonderful to hear. Really, really respect that.
Don, thank you so much. We're out of time now. Please, website where we can find the program, we can find you at, we can find the book.
Yeah, 60secondstoyes.com. So it's all spelled out, no punctuation. 60secondstoyes.com. We do workshops all over the country. The workshop is under $50 for an entire day. It is not a commercial. It is the workshop. We're out to get this message out and to solve the economic woes one entrepreneur at a time. So the book is there. The book's on Amazon. But we want you to come and see the live workshop and see how this actually works.
Great. Hey, Don, thank you so much for your time. I've had fun. I appreciate the interview.
Me too, Mike. I appreciate that. It's wonderful to be on here. I appreciate your support here.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night.
That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Bob Hamer with us. He's returned. He was a year ago since he's been here. The new book is Targets Down, and that is a novel. He's a 26-year veteran of the FBI, received the FBI's Director's Award for Distinguished Service. His award-winning true crime memoir, The Last Undercover, was published in 2008, followed by his first novel, Enemies Among Us. That was in 2010. In addition to his writing, he's consulted for television shows such as Law and Order, SVU, The Sleeper Cell. He's a member of the Writers Guild of America, also a Marine Corps veteran and law school graduate. And let us say, Bob, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, great to be back with you again. I enjoyed listening to your previous guest. I think in many respects, as an undercover agent, I never considered myself a salesman, but actually I was. And there,
sure.
Just listening to him talking about the sales and the listening and everything, and many of the targets that we would actually look at, you know, you had to assess them, and you were either selling yourself, but so many of them, you just sat there and let them talk about themselves. You know, you didn't want to cloud up the evidence tapes with you talking about yourself. You just allowed them to incriminate themselves. So that was interesting applying those principles to undercover work.
Now, by the way, Bob, isn't it interesting, we used the word, that the neurosciences of today, you know, if we go back 15, 20, 25 years, people were aware of it, but it wasn't out in the public as it is now. It wasn't looked at for almost every facet of everything we do, marketing and, you know, the ads and so on and so forth, in your writing, and also with FBI, et cetera. It's a fascinating subject, and I think that they're just scratching the surface with it now.
Yeah, I think there, you know, there's so many new avenues that we're discovering, and just being able to understand ourselves and each other and how we communicate, and those communication skills are so important.
Oh, by the way, before we go too far, Semper Fi.
Hey, Semper Fi. Thank you very much. I was joking with some people just this past weekend that the two greatest things for me about having a new book published is, one, my wife thinks I'm busy, so I can close the office door and really take a nap, but I've been fortunate enough, I go down at least once a week to Balboa Hospital and get to visit our wounded Marines. And it allows me a chance to give them more than a handshake and just give them a book. And I have been honored to be in the presence of real American heroes. And I think when you spend as much time as I have in Hollywood, you see the wannabe heroes. But these are real heroes.
Oh, no, by the way, no question about it. I do really think the one thing I got out of the boot camp when I went through was that camaraderie. There was, I think every kid coming out of high school should go through Marine Corps boot camp. And the reason for that is there's a sense of responsibility that you learn. You don't do the job, you're going to get kicked in your rear end. I mean, quote unquote, that's the way it is, or it was anyway. And that's called responsibility. It's called consequence. They run through life today without having to worry about consequence. And that's where I think something like a boot camp would be the most wonderful thing for most people. And then when you've got somebody at your back, you don't care what gender they are, what ethnicity they are, whatever they are, they're at your back. And it's a whole different story.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's that whole concept of the fire team, and that you are part of something. And I get upset when I read the news and I see, you know, this 23 or 24-year star or starlet doing something irresponsible, and yet the people we have defending us are 18 and 19-year-old kids, and they're the ones that are taking on the responsibility for our freedoms. And I don't think enough people recognize who it is that's out there on the front lines protecting us.
Yeah, by the way, I don't want to give my age away, but when I went through boot camp, we were handling M1s. True story. The fire team was, you know, we had, you know, three M1s and one BAR guy.
Okay, good. Well, good for you.
Yeah, that was a while back. That was a while back. Now let's go to the story. The story in and of itself. What is it about the story that's going to capture me? What do I want to read it?
Well, again, this is the FBI. It's an undercover case. It's a man, Matt Hogan, my protagonist, who,
yeah,
there's a lot of Bob Hamer, name only he's better looking and has more hair. But this is a man who's facing some of the questions and challenges that we do in our everyday lives, except he's doing it in a life and death situation. And so I hope that the reader will come away entertained, but also enlightened, because one, you're going to get a view of the FBI that you really haven't seen before, because I'm bringing this to you based upon my experiences, not based upon a weekend ride along or sitting down and talking with FBI agents and then trying to put that into a fictional account. But also I'm talking about subjects that are happening today. In Targets Down, Matt Hogan is tasked with investigating the murder of two people and someone who injured an FBI agent's wife. It takes him undercover. He goes into Russian organized crime, neo-Nazis. It involves illegal immigration, the sex slave industry, things that are topical today. And you're going to be educated as well as entertained.
Now, by the way, in today's world, when you say, by the way, do you happen to know Kathy Puckett at all?
No, she's
an ex FBI counterterrorism profiler, et cetera. She's on the show once a week, and I think anybody who's been involved in that has had to have a fascinating life, and especially looking at what's going on today as opposed to the way it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. There are so many things that somebody has to put up with, and I believe that the quote-unquote fantasy novels that aren't truly fantasy, I mean, you got reality going, the foundation of what drives the protagonist in the stories. But the difference in what happens today, sometimes I get actually shocked to think that the amount of information that flows, there's no secrecy anymore, almost. And it gets to a point whereby if you are an FBI agent, if you are a CIA, if you're not very careful, you could get sued and go to jail for the way you talk to somebody who's a possible terrorist.
Well, I you know, there is that concern. I think there's always a concern that you may, in a book, you may be revealing too much. I know that everything that I write has to go back to headquarters for approval. So,
well, sure. By the way, I don't mean, Bob, I don't mean what goes on in a novel. I'm talking about what goes on in the media.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah,
what goes on in the media. And I think that's got to be very scary because, you know, we've got to a point today where, you know, we'll say something like, we're going to attack XYZ. This is what we're going to use, and we're going to hit them at 7 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. What else would the enemy want to know, except what you?
Oh no, you're absolutely right, Michael. I mean, it's almost to the point. If you're going to pick to be a spy, you want to be a spy for another country in the United States because we reveal all our secrets.
Yeah.
So you just all you got to do is pick up the paper, and you can write your intelligence reports and send them back to your. To your case handler back there in, you know, whatever country you're working for. We do reveal everything. I mean, we set out what our withdrawal dates are, when we're going to start bringing home the troops. We've been to the point, even locally, where you'll have the press out there because we're going to be doing a series of arrests. And so, you know, the boss of the local office wants to make sure he gets plenty of high-profile publicity, so he'll send the press out there in a media van when you're going in to make the arrest. We have embedded reporters overseas. We practically have embedded reporters here in the United States.
And then what we have is we have Twitter. You could be right in the middle of something. I think when Bin Laden got it a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, somebody tweeted that he had got it, and everybody knew about it before it was into the local press.
Absolutely. I learned about it. I just happened to check Facebook, and someone had posted it at Facebook, and I turned on the news channels, and it wasn't on yet. And it was just I learned about it Facebook before it even came scrawling across the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, no, and I think that today it's almost amazing. I don't know how we get away with anything. And when it really comes down to it, to escape into a novel, which is wonderful because everybody that reads the novel in some way, shape, or form is going to recognize themselves within the plot. They're going to be able to relate to one of those characters in the plot. I think that's what keeps us captured. And I think novels in and of themselves are the greatest entertaining escape that you can possibly get. Because the movies are insanity today. I can't relate to somebody running down the side of a wall and taking on 50 guys. It doesn't work. But in the novels, there's where the real creativity happens, because you start to see yourself within the novel and you become those people, that person.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I hope that there are still people out there that love to curl up with a good book or even their iPad.
Yeah.
And read a novel, because I'm afraid we're becoming a society that it was bad enough if you couldn't put it on Facebook, you know, in a little bit of a squib, and now if you can't get it in a tweet, I'm not sure in 10 years how much reading we're going to be able to do or going to want to do, because if you can't get it done in, 141 tweets or whatever, we may not be interested in reading about it.
Oh, I think what's going to happen, I'm going to give you a forecast. 40, 50 years from now, we'll go back on the air and we'll prove this is right. I really believe when it comes down to it, they'll take a kid who's 8 or 9 years old, they'll put a wire on the side of his head, they'll press a button, the kid will have as much education as a high schooler will have, and then you go to the next step and you don't have to go through the process. It's going to be that fast, and I think that will happen down the road.
I certainly can't argue with you.
I don't want to see it, but I still think that'll happen. Humanity's going right down the tubes. With the advent of all this technology. By the way, how much technology is there in the book?
Very little, because I'm not very technical. So,
by the way, I'm applauding. Yeah, no, I'm applauding. The technology is one thing, but people are another thing. That's the key. I can't relate to an iPod, but I can relate to somebody's thoughts about moving into a particular direction, making a decision about doing something. I can get into that. I can't get into a piece of machinery.
Right. I understand that. And I think that when you're dealing, especially when you're an undercover agent, you know, you can't rely on technology. You have to rely on your wits. You have to rely on your own thought process and how you are going to move in and move out, extricate yourself from a situation. As I talk about it in the book, as he goes into this new locale, he sizes up the covers and concealments, the escapes, so that you do that automatically when you're working undercover, because you want to know where your exits are in case you need to leave in a hurry. So,
Bob, no, we do that as talk show hosts. we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, bobhamer.net, and that's 1M, bobhamer.net. I have some sample chapters of all of my books available there. There's an interesting YouTube that was put together by a wounded Marine for me about involved some undercover video that I took when I was undercover in NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. So there's some interesting things on the website that maybe your listeners would like to access.
Wonderful. Hey, Bob, thank you so much for coming back in. I appreciate the time, and it's always great when you're here.
Thanks so much, and Semper Fi.
Semper Fi.
Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's falling. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this bit.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
All there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain